This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Among people who consider themselves nature lovers, there seem to be two types of reaction to an animal in the wild. Those in the first group say to themselves, "Wow, what a beautiful animal. I wish I could take it home as a pet." The second respond more like, "What a magnificent creature. I hope human beings leave it well alone." This hour, we get an update from the man who co-founded the now internationally renowned Wildlife Center of Virginia. He's got plenty of stories on how animals hurt in the wild have gotten help from humans, as well as tales of people who thought they were helping, but actually made the situation worse. Might there be useful lessons here? One hint, Ed Clark says something as simple as where you place a bird feeder can affect all manner of critters. Details on that and many more of Mr. Clark's always fascinating stories right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Got thoughts about life in the wild? The head of the Wildlife Center of Virginia is with us, and your questions, comments, insights, welcome by phone at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, 888-967-2825. Ed Clark, it is terrific to see you back in the Insight Studio.
Well, Tom, it's awfully nice to be back with you and your listeners and your listeners online.
So, what thoughts about wildlife have been most on your mind of late?
Oh, my goodness. My mind is just a whir with wild thoughts most of the time. The Wildlife Center, of course, this time of the year is finishing up our paperwork and our administration and all of our dealings from 2014 and plowing headlong into 2015. We had a very good year last year. 2014 closed with the organization in very strong shape, good financial shape. We had a lower patient load than we sometimes have, and that was, we think, in large part due to the very tough winter that so many animals had a year ago. As we talked about it, I think the last time I was here, in the winter of 2013-14, the acorn crop basically failed in the Appalachian Mountains. And so an awful lot of animals were coming out of the woods looking for food. A lot of the animals that needed the good nutritional support for successful reproduction did not find it. And so this spring was spring last year was pretty tough, with a lot of animals that normally started showing up at our doorstep in March not showing up until sometimes late April to even into May. Things, you know, baby squirrels as an example, because, of course, the squirrels are very, very dependent on the nut crop, and their reproduction is very dependent on the condition of the adults that are reproducing, the females in particular. This year, we have seen a bumper crop of acorns in the forest, and animals seem to be going into the winter in very good shape, lots and lots of food. As soon as the acorns started falling last summer, the number of nuisance calls and sightings of wild animals out of place, if you will, the black bear in town, those calls dried up almost immediately. As soon as food supply in the woods was available, the animals went back to their preferred food source and in their preferred habitat. So we hope things are back to normal for now.
A large part of what you do, of what the Wildlife Center is a hospital for injured and sick wild animals. Are many of those at least injured who come in injured by interaction with people, cars, or something else?
Well, without question, the overwhelming influence that causes injured animals and even healthy animals to come to our door is some type of interaction with humans. It can be a direct interaction where baby bird has left the nets as a natural consequence of its growth. Somebody picks it up and takes it home and then keeps it for 3 or 4 days before they bring it in. Or a deer fawn that has been left alone by its mother, and people come along and find it. They don't see the mother. They assume something's wrong, and they take it home. Those are the kinds of situations in which it might be sort of militant compassion, if you will, well-intentioned people doing the wrong thing. So a lot of our work is educating the public about appropriate interactions. But we also, of course, get a very, very high percentage of the animals coming in as a result of automobile collisions, interactions with domestic animals, our pets in particular. and collisions with windows, particularly for songbirds. We get an awful lot of that this time of the year, birds flying into the windows. The sun is low in the sky. A lot of people put feeders right outside their windows, and there are quite a few animals that just can't deal with that reflection, or they can see through it. They think they can fly through it, and it doesn't work out so well for them.
So I wanted to make sure I was tracking what you were saying, Ed, about the lower number of patients at the Wildlife Center last year. In part, that was because the food supply was less, and so young animals were being born later.
Well, or they either weren't being born at all, or they didn't survive because their mothers, in particular, either did not have the nutritional condition to support the pregnancy. So one of the things, wonderful things in nature, is that nature tends to adjust for change. And so in periods of very, very low food supply, the rate of reproduction also drops so that things stay in balance. Animals are typically, when we talk about the balance of nature, that's not just a throwaway cliche. Nature really does have natural mechanisms. So when the food supply goes down, the very expensive physiological processes that, like reproduction, one of the most expensive things physiologically in terms of how much energy and how much caloric input and how much it takes out of the body of the reproducing female, when the food supply is not there, she may skip a year. She may not get pregnant, or the pregnancy may be terminated naturally. She may reabsorb the fetus because she doesn't have the nutritional body condition to support the pregnancy to term. And so we believe that that was a lot of what was going on. And the fact is that the correlation is not always as obvious as this, but in this case, it was pretty obvious.
I mentioned a few moments ago that our phone number is pretty easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. I should also note that you can talk to Ed, well, communicate might be the right word, through Facebook. You can find us listed on Facebook as WMRA's Virginia Insight, and you're welcome to post a question or comment there. And we already have some coming in. Ed, this is from Carrie, who has a question that looks like it's related to just what we were talking about. Carrie says, I noticed this morning that the Wildlife Center has the first bear cubs of 2015. Any predictions as to the number of bears the center might see this year and the factors which could cause an increase or decrease in admissions?
Well, Carrie from Ontario, Canada, is one of our very, very special friends and someone we hold in very, very high regard.
Had no idea this was somebody you knew.
Yeah, okay. This is someone, and our world has changed, and our friends are everywhere. But people are very, very interested in the nuance of what we do, and this is a perfect example. This question is one that it really reflects what's happened at the Wildlife Center over the last several years. 2 years ago, we had 42 bears that came in. Last year, that number dropped more than in half. This year, we've already had our first three brought in last Friday, brand new bear cubs that are about the size of guinea pigs, and their eyes are still closed. Very, very young bears, and they're having to be cared for around the clock. We've got people coming in the middle of the night to feed these bears.
Brought in because their mother?
Somebody was clearing up brush, and the mother had had these cubs. When they den, they're not always in caves or some of the sort of folkloric images that people create. Sometimes the mothers will simply literally make a nest on the ground under an overhang or a stump or next to a log. And in this case, somebody was out cutting wood and clearing brush, clearing some land, and found these three cubs. Now, whether the mother would have come back to the cubs or not is sort of a moot question, because by the time we found out about it, that was no longer an option. But the fact is that we're really worried about these cubs. We're not worried that we can keep them alive. That's the easy part. But the hard part is keeping them wild. When an animal like this opens its eyes and the first thing it sees is a human being, it's hard to go back and teach it to be afraid of a human being. And so right now, we work very, very closely with our colleagues at the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, and particularly with our state bear biologist, Jamie Sajecki, and we're looking for, or we, that's the royal we. They are out in the woods looking for a female who is still in the den, who may have cubs of about this age, so that we can take these three little babies and put them in with a wild mother so that they can actually be raised in the wild. And we have a window of time in which this can happen, but we need to get it done as soon as possible. And to be perfectly honest about it, if we cannot find a place for a wild bear to raise these three cubs, their chances of returning to the wild is slim to none.
So in terms of Carrie's question about predictions for numbers of admissions, numbers of animals you're likely to see this year, based on what I've heard you say already, it sounds like this might be a year for a high number because the food supply is so good.
You're paying attention, Tom, or I'm being unusually clear. That's great. No, you've got it right. We had a very, very good mast crop. Mast being the kind of general term that refers to acorns, other types of nuts, berries, the types of things that that bears eat, and many other forms of wildlife. So they've gone into the winter in very, very good condition. And we really expect that we will see very high rates of reproduction. I mean, these were triplet bear cubs, and that in and of itself is unusual, not unheard of by any stretch of the imagination. But typically, one or two cubs is normal for a female, but triplets in a good year becomes much more common, and even quadruplets. But we hope to get these babies back out, but this is the type of thing that requires us to have more than one trick up our sleeves. We've built our new bear facility for managing and rearing black bears, but there are certain things we simply cannot do, and certainly cannot do as well as a wild mother. And so now we're pulling out all the stops to get out there, find one, tranquilize her, get these babies in with her.
Our guest, Ed Clark, president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia. If you want to speak with him by phone, we are at 888-967-2825. You can remember that as 888-WMRA-TALK. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. We have this Facebook post from Mark, who says, I just bought some ridgeland in Copper Hill in Floyd County. Will I lose predator birds if I cut old-growth timber? I love the big birds and want to keep them soaring my way. Can I do things to make the property more hospitable to them?
Well, actually, that's an ironic question, because one of the things that attracts predatory birds to hunt on property is what we call early successional habitat. So if he creates, if he timbers the land, the likelihood is that the prey base, or the small animals on which raptors will feed, will actually increase, because there'll be more vegetation at ground level, which is where these animals live. The mice and voles and rabbits on which red-tailed hawks and the other great horned owls prey, they're not living in the tops of 100-foot-tall trees. So cutting old growth can actually enhance the diversity on your property. I myself have a tract of land in Pennsylvania. It's 50 acres. And when I was a kid, which was a very long time ago, we planted pine trees and did everything we could to reforest that land that had been very badly clear-cut. And now that forest is maturing, and the prey base for many types of predators is all but gone. So I'm having to look at the same thing. To have a diverse ecosystem, you need diverse habitat. And that is one of the things that a landowner can do. And we really encourage folks who have forest land, and especially mountain land, because mountain land is a special consideration, to consult with the county forester or even the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, because they can advise you on how to timber that land in a way that both protects the integrity of the soil and diversifies your wildlife populations. Most of the mountain land here in Virginia has a very low, what we call a site index, which is the rate at which trees regenerate. So you can cut mature forests, but it takes an awful long time for them to come back. So they need to be cut carefully.
Ed Clark, I've heard a rumor that at your home in Augusta County in Virginia, you've come up with a strategy that has greatly reduced the squirrel damage to your house. So I'm going to ask you to give that secret away. And we've got a bunch of other questions for you from our listeners. If you've just joined us, Ed Clark from the Wildlife Center of Virginia is with us. Phone number 888-WMRA-TALK. And we'll be back in just about a minute. He is co-founder and current leader of the wildlife advocacy and rescue operation that began its work 33 years ago. Ed Clark, president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Now, I don't want you to think that I see any association between these next two, but I just want to mention them both because I don't want to forget to ask you either one, Ed. One, the thing about the squirrels.
All right.
And two, the fact that you've lately been spending some time with our state lawmakers.
Ah, yes.
So let's go to the squirrels first, and then we'll go to the legislation that you're concerned
from,
about.
From squirrels to squirrely. Okay, we can do that. Well, I had been a great lover of feeding wildlife, and I have a big deck around three sides of my house, and the squirrels were just giving me a fit. Because I'd put just spread bird seed out, sunflower seed on the deck railing, and they'd come and just have a ball. And they, you know, if I ran out of sunflower seeds on the deck, they'd all be at the picture window with their little tin cups raking it against the window and demanding attention and demanding food. And I enjoyed them, but I actually had individual squirrels, and I could identify these squirrels. There were just two or three individuals that just were horribly damaging my house, chewing on stuff. So I ended up putting an automatic corn feeder out in my woods about 50 yards from my house. And of course, I can't use it during the deer season. You're prohibited from by law from feeding deer or putting out food that attract or feed deer. But now I've just being able to get it cranked up again now that the deer seasons are over. And it has been remarkable because it goes off twice a day and it sprays corn out into the bushes and the leaves. And, you know, when it goes off, there's this teeming carpet of gray fur out there foraging for the corn that is sprayed around. And they've left my house alone now for 2 years. And I'm pretty pleased with that. I still feed the birds, but I use squirrel-proof bird feeders. And so the one or two squirrels that haven't learned the trick will come around and entertain us royally trying to get into those.
Well, I promised I wanted to ask you about what you've been doing in Richmond.
Sure.
But it looks like our first call that's coming in from Afton is related to that very issue. So let me invite Wynn to join us here on Virginia Insight. Thank you for calling, Wynn. Ask your question or comment, and I think it's going to be related to what Ed's been doing lately in Richmond. Please go ahead.
Okay, sure. Hi, Ed. Wynn Winfrey here.
Hey, Wynn. How are you doing?
Fine. I need to give you more money.
Yes, that's always a good way to start a conversation. And when there's a will, we want to be in it.
Well, you know he already is. You already are. What I'm calling about, two things, really. One, I wish you would address the subject of how many small animals that are killed or just by a very scratch become eventually die of septicemia from either people's domestic house cats or feral cats. And I find domestic house cats being the worst. And also, I actually had some endangered species of a bird that the bird, you know, the club over in Stanton, of which I'm a member, came over and took pictures and everything, and all four of them were dead within 48 hours of leaving the nest. And I became my usual angry about something like that. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about, please do address that. I don't think people realize that. Also, that in many, many countries, it's illegal to have a non-neutered cat or dog. I know in Australia it is, and I've researched other countries where it's the same thing.
Wynn, I need you to hold on for me because we're getting lots of other calls, and I realize that you had 2 points, but we may not have time to get to the second. Let's get at least to the first.
Okay, well, there may be both points there. When we start talking about cats, it's religion. And so there are people out there, I can just imagine right now that their hackles are raising, saying, oh, here he goes again. And yet the truth is that in the last 10 years, the Wildlife Center of Virginia has received 2,970 small birds and small mammals that are cat victims. Just literally two dozen shy of 3,000 animals that have come to our doors, and these are confirmed cat victims. Now, we don't know whether this is Fluffy the house cat that's simply allowed out into the yard to forage and pillage, or whether these are feral cats. And probably the truth is the patients we get may be more actually pet cats, owned cats, than the ferals. There's no way of telling, but these are animals that are confirmed victims, not speculation on our part. And among the small birds that have had any contact with a cat and either had the skin broken by claw or tooth, even the ones that make it to the Wildlife Center of Virginia suffer an 81% mortality. So 4 out of 5 of those animals are going to die in spite of our best efforts. So if you have a cat at home that you let into the yard and it brings in a small bird and you catch the bird and the bird flies away, don't deceive yourself by thinking that that bird's going to fly off and have a happy life. He's going to fly off and die from infection within 48 to 72 hours. The small mammals like chipmunks and squirrels and rabbits and wide variety of other things, the mortality rate is a little better, but it's still 3 out of 4 will die from a cat bite or a cat attack.
And the legislation that you've been talking to state lawmakers about has to do with some ideas about feral cats that you think are wrongheaded.
Well, this is a very, very passionate debate that goes on because the people who love these cats love them beyond all reason. And God bless them. You know, they care for these animals, and these animals certainly need care.
Love tends to be like that.
Well, part of the...
No, and I mean that seriously.
No, that's very...
If you have a deep sense of affection for any kind of animal, sometimes reason goes out the door.
Well, and that's very true. I mean, those of us who have our pets know that we would rush into the burning building to save them.
Right.
And that sort of thing goes on. But part of what the debate is today and what is raging in Richmond now is whether or not people who are engaged in trap, neuter, release of feral cats, where they go out and catch these wild cats, bring them in, have them neutered so they can't reproduce, which can't be a bad thing. They will often vaccinate them, but then they take them and turn them loose again. And it is in the act of returning them to the wild where a lot of the controversy comes in, because it's against the law to abandon an animal in Virginia. And the battle is whether or not the people that are practicing the TNR, the trap, neuter, return, should be legally responsible for the animal once they take it into their possession. And the battle last week was a piece of legislation that had been introduced basically saying that people who are practicing trap, neuter, release of cats are completely absolved of any legal responsibility for the cats or for anything they do in the course of trapping them, neutering, or returning them. So it's basically a above the law kind of thing. And there are many of us who take very, very strong exception to that because there are no criteria established for where feral cats can be released, what kind of colonies can be there, how many cats can be there. And there's a big battle going on right here in Harrisonburg, Virginia, between the SPCA and one of the non-shelter organizations that practices TNR. And the issues in Richmond that we raised were the fact that we need to assure that when the discussion is going on about feral cats, that part of the discussion has got to be impacts on wildlife, and this is what the caller was addressing just a few moments ago, but also human health and safety, because there are profound human health risks that come from interaction with any type of free-ranging animal, but particularly semi-domestic, semi-tame cats that are now being colonized in many areas like public parks, around school campuses, factories, parking lots, communities, developments, things of this nature. These aren't really tame cats. They aren't really owned cats. And the TNR advocates are making a big deal saying, that's not my cat. I just got it neutered. That doesn't make it my cat. But that means that nobody's responsible. When that cat bites someone, and perhaps a child playing in the park, the cat comes up, child tries to pick it up, is bitten, the cat runs off. Well, that child has got to go through a very painful and extremely expensive treatment for rabies exposure. And many of the TNR folks say, oh, these cats are vaccinated for rabies. Well, okay, that works the first year. But what about after that? We have no record keeping on these colonies, no way, nobody to even ask, because the people doing this are saying, not my cat, don't come to my door and ask me questions about it. They'll clip the ear tip off when the cat's being anesthetized during surgery. But there's no way of knowing whether that ear was clipped last week or 10 years ago. And rabies is certainly one big issue.
I think I've heard you say before that the biggest instigator of rabies in humans is from cat bites?
Well, no, it's actually the predominant cause of post-exposure treatment. So one of the reasons few people die from rabies is because we have a very effective treatment. So if you've been bitten by an animal that is rabid or potentially rabid, if you go to the doctor, go to the emergency room right away and report that, you can be administered an immunoglobulin that is rich in rabies antibodies. And actually there's an entire therapeutic.
So the most common cause for humans to be treated for possible rabies
is
cat bites.
By an overwhelming majority.
And the other argument I understand you're making with state lawmakers is that when it comes to cats, feral or otherwise, there's more than just rabies to be concerned about?
Oh, absolutely. Toxoplasmosis is a blood parasite that protozoan that is the reservoir are cats. And it's very, very hazardous to pregnant women, hazardous to children. We're now finding that the protozoan is moving into white-tailed deer. Big study in Ohio, not so very far away from here, that showed that the white-tailed deer population in areas where the feral cat population was high, that the deer were heavily infested with this protozoal parasite just south of us.
And what happens if somebody shoots one of those deer and uses it for food?
Well, they better not be eating it rare. Let's put it that way. That one of the ways that you can contract the disease is by consuming contaminated meat. And that's a big issue.
Wynn, thank you so very much for your call. Ed Clark from the Wildlife Center of Virginia, our guest. If you want to talk to him by phone, 888-WMRA-TALK, the easy way to remember our phone number. Or you can post on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And that was Heidi's method of choice. She says, I'm curious about the environmental role various common wild animals play. What benefit, if any, do we get from having skunks, opossums, raccoons, and groundhogs around?
Well, it's the question suggests a particularly, to use a big word, an anthropocentric human-based perspective on things, because the suggestion there is that somehow wildlife has got to benefit humans to have any inherent value at all. And while I understand the question, it's not a perspective that I encourage. It's sort of human arrogance, if you will, to think that the only animals that have value are ones that give us pleasure.
But there is benefit to the environment.
There are great benefits to the environment. And for an example, just to run down the list, the skunks are scavengers. They're mousers. And they do the same job in the wild that many other predators will do. The opossums are among nature's janitors. They eat insects, a lot of carrion, a lot of cleanup of that. Raccoons are also predators. And, the groundhogs are strictly vegetarians, but the groundhog burrow that farmers hate so much also provides habitat for many other species of wildlife that use those burrows, go down into those holes. Foxes, for an example, will often excavate a groundhog burrow. And it one of the things that is it's difficult to get people to really sit back and contemplate is when we talk about the web of nature and the intricate ways in which animals relate to one another, it's all about a balance. And the thing with natural predation of natural prey is these animals have evolved side by side. So if we have a large number of insects, grasshoppers out there, there are going to be a larger number of birds eating those grasshoppers in a natural setting, larger number of animals like raccoons that are also great consumers of insects. doing their thing. And if that prey base disappears or that food source goes away, the population of those animals will go down. Now, what has often happened that causes people to interact with these animals in ways that are unpleasant is we've gone into rural areas, we've gone into wildlife habitat, and we've created artificial food sources. And then we expect these animals not to pay attention. From something as simple as the garbage can that a bungee cord can keep the lid on, but raccoons are going to get in it because they're smart animals and it smells like food and they're going to go there. And a lot of folks really take a position that somehow nature is a catalog. I want to have these animals. I don't want to have those animals. But I don't want to live in the city. I want to come live in the countryside. And we hear it all the time, particularly
over. You can't necessarily do the Chinese order from column A and column B or
Can, but only on the dinner plate.
Okay. So thank you very much for that question on Facebook, Heidi. We're going next by phone to Woodstock. Glenn, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for Ed Clark, please.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Speaking of the dinner plate, I like growing sweet corn, but apparently the local squirrels like to dig up the corn before it ever gets a chance to germinate. I've got a fence around it. I've even gone to the length of putting 3 feet of chicken wire with one strand of electric fence 3 inches out along the top row of the chicken wire, and then I really like to have sweet corn.
I get you. You have definitely got a common scenario going there, and I'm not sure I have any magic answers. If I had the final answer to that question, I'd be calling in from the yacht rather than sitting here in the studio. But there are actually a number of products out there that can deter certain rodents, and a squirrel is a rodent, from digging up the seeds until they germinate. There are products that are based in capsaicin, the pepper oil. There are powders that can be put on the corn seed itself. And my dad has this running battle in his huge garden as well, and he has gone to the great length of actually buying himself a greenhouse frame and covering it with chicken wire. And it's a monstrosity in his yard in Fairfax County, Virginia, and I'm sure the neighbors just love it, but it's a tough thing. It really is. But as far as just a physical barrier to keep them out, that's a pretty difficult thing. But the local garden supplies, there's one product called Ropel, which is kind of a brand name for rodent repellent. It has to be applied regularly, but it can and does
work. Excuse me just a moment. Glenn, we're going to hit the break soon. I just want to check. Have you tried any of these products?
Actually, what I've tried doing is as soon as I plant the corn, actually sprinkling milorganite over the surface of the ground to try and mask the scent of anything.
So some of the other things that Ed's mentioning might be worth a try?
Well, the Ropel I could use once the corn germinates, but it's getting to the point of getting it up out of the ground.
Yeah.
On our gardening shows, there's been mentioned before for keeping some animals, like deer, away, a product that's made out of wolf's urine. Does that apply to squirrels?
Well, I think that's probably more of a marketing strategy than a true...
We've actually had people call in and say that it works, but they said it worked for deer, not for squirrels.
Yeah, well, it's... try the garden centers out because there are a number of things, but the pepper product is something you apply to the corn before you plant it.
Glenn, thanks for your call. We'll be back. Environmental activist, wildlife rescue specialist, professional consultant, motivational speaker, and more. Ed Clark, president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We're going next to Stanton. Diane, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, Ed. A little problem here. I have owned several cats myself, but I've never let them go out, so they were indoor cats.
Good for you.
And I'm living next door to a neighbor who has street cats, and I love birds, so I've got bird feeders all over, and these cats are always hanging around, and I'm always throwing water at them. But I'm trying to figure out how to have a conversation with my neighbor about this issue. I don't want the cats killing the birds, and I know they will, because that's what cats do.
Diane, are you on a speakerphone by chance?
Pardon me?
Are you on a speakerphone by chance?
Yeah, I'll turn it off.
We're getting an awful lot of echo, but I think we've got enough of the sense of your question to let Ed respond.
Sure. It's a tough thing. Again, when we start talking about people's pets or the animals they love, it's often very, very difficult to have a rational discussion. I have the same situation. I live outside of Waynesboro, have 6 acres of woods. I keep all of my cats indoors, have for 30 years. And yet neighbors who have cats that they allow to go out, they think it's cool that they go out to hunt, but they come to my property to do so. And what I have found is, you know, you can scare the cat off, but trying to get the neighbor to take responsibility for their pet is tough. And in one case, that one particular cat that was just unusually obnoxious coming around the house and marking the front door and making my cats crazy. I trapped it in a live trap humanely. It didn't hurt the cat. It wasn't the cat's fault. And simply went to his door and asked if it was his cat, knowing full well that it was. And because I said, you know, the cat is out. My dogs are out. It's imperiled. It's doing dangerous things. And it's damaging my property. And I was just sure your cat wouldn't be doing these kinds of things. And so he hemmed and hawed and whatever, but that was the last time I saw that cat on my property. And it's a difficult thing to engage somebody. If you kind of draw the parallel, how do you tell your neighbor that their children are misbehaving when they're not looking? Because there's a real strong parallel there. How do you talk to a parent about a misbehaving child the same way you talk to somebody about a misbehaving pet? They're doing things that are affecting you. You know the neighbor. My conversation would be to assume the neighbor does not want to do things or be responsible for things that would mark them as a bad neighbor. So you wanted to bring this to their attention in a friendly way before you have to start being mean to the cat and see how it goes.
Diane, thanks so much for your call. We have this on Facebook from Aziz. Actually, it's a very long post. Anybody wants to can read it on Facebook, but I think I need to just grab the essence of this. Ed, I showed you the post a little bit earlier, so you'd see the whole thing that Aziz was talking about. Bottom line, he's got feral cats around his home. He wants them to be appropriately taken care of, but he's concerned about rabies or other things that they might infect other animals or people. And his question is, should he try and trap them and see if he can get inexpensive vaccinations or should he have them destroyed?
Boy, therein lies the crux of the issue. The question that he had in part of the question was that he feeds a colony of cats. So he is encouraging these cats to be at his property. By providing food for them. And then he talks about other types of wildlife. And he mentioned skunks and raccoons and opossums that come around every night as well. And somehow the connection between those two events or sequence of events isn't obvious, apparently. But if you put out food for cats, cats aren't the only ones eating it. That's one of the big issues is without regulation, without some type of standard protocol, when people are putting out these huge food supplies for a colony of feral cats and they go put out the food and then they don't come back again for a week and until they put out more food, there are all types of natural scavengers coming to that area to eat. It's bringing in all types of...
Understood, but Aziz's bottom line question seems to be he wants to do the right thing. Should he be capturing these feral cats and getting them vaccinated? And if so, is there an inexpensive way to do that, was part of his question. Or should he, as much as he cares for these cats, to protect everyone, should he have them destroyed?
Well, if he's talking about a risk to his children, which these cats clearly do present, as he is talking about living on a farm, feeding the feral cats on the farm, and they're interacting with his kids— he's doing something that is dangerous. It really is a dangerous situation. because there is such a risk that rabies is the disease he mentions, but there are so many other things that these cats can bring in, and the fact that they're being fed in colonies.
I almost get that you really don't want to advise him on whether to have the cats destroyed or vaccinated.
Well, he needs to change something there. He either needs to stop feeding them or feed them in a way that the wild animals are not attracted, or he needs to get into a program where he's going to vaccinate them. If you want to bring these animals into close proximity to people, you are accepting the responsibility of bringing a disease vector into contact with your children.
And then once you do vaccinate them, that's something that has to be repeated every year?
Well, and that's one of the big kind of flaws in the argument that the trap, neuter, release strategy is the best strategy. And in a sort of a microcosm, it makes a lot of sense. But rabies vaccine, depending on the vaccine you use, is only good for a year. And people will say, okay, it typically will convey immunity longer than that. But how do you know? And the bottom line is it may or may not work for more than a year. But even if the cat has been vaccinated and is not carrying rabies, if it bites someone, they're going to need the post-exposure treatment, because unless you have your hands on that cat and can confine it for the period of quarantine, you can't establish that it doesn't have rabies. And the children become the victims.
If he decides to go the vaccination route, he asks, is there an inexpensive way? Are there organizations that will do this?
There are many organizations out there that can offer not only assistance with neutering the animals, vaccinating the animals, but advice on how to manage the colonies.
Can you name some of them?
Well, there some of the groups that are out there here in the area. There's a group called, I believe it's Cat's Cradle. There's another group, the name of which escapes me right now. But the question also needs to be asked, what's the health of these cats? Because that's one of the big debates. The two biggest national animal advocacy groups, the Humane Society of the United States and People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, are diametrically opposed on this issue. Humane Society supports the idea of feral cat colonies. PETA, one of the most extreme animal advocacy groups, they consider that to be the abandonment of cats, and they are vigorously opposed to taking cats and just dumping them back out in the wild, even if food is provided. They advocate euthanizing the cats.
We're going next to Churchville. Nancy, thank you for calling us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for the president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, Ed Clark, please.
Hi, Ed. This is Nancy. How are you?
I'm well, Nancy. Nice talking with you today. Thanks for calling in.
I live in the woods, and I have three bay windows, and I have a huge amount of cardinals. And the males, all of that, they attack, fly into the bay windows. And I have tried I've tried cutting out owl shapes and all sorts of stuff, and I can clean the bay windows that are low, but the ones that's really high off the ground, I have to hire somebody to come and take the bird impressions off. How do I get these male birds to stop flying in to my bay windows?
Well, what you are dealing with there, Nancy, is testosterone poisoning in wildlife. These male birds are extremely territorial. Particularly during the mating season, not so bad this time of the year, but during the spring and summer, extremely territorial. And when they see a reflection in the window, they assume that that's an interloper coming to steal their woman or their female cardinal or their nesting territory or what have you, and they will literally fight until they collapse from exhaustion. I have actually seen male cardinals fighting with red feather spots in the middle of the highway where another cardinal was killed by a car, and they continue to fight just that red clump of feathers until they themselves succumb. There are actually a couple of things you can do. Some of this is kind of roll your own, do it yourself types of treatments. Some is a little more expensive, but in fact more effective. The try-it-yourself, you can get surveyor's ribbon, the plastic tape that you'd use to mark stakes or things of this nature, and just taking long ribbons of that, thumbtack it or tape it to the top of the window and let it flutter in front of the window. Now, that creates an aesthetic presence that you may or may not be willing to tolerate. But that oftentimes, just that little bit of movement in front of the window can not only break up the impression, but gives the bird something else about which to think as he's getting ready to fly into the window. The real answer that can stop this problem is a window film that is available. It's like the tinted windows on cars, but you can get it. It's designed for homes, and it's just a non-reflective coating for your window. And it's like putting cellophane over your window, if you will, but it's got a non-reflective surface so that the bird is far less likely to see his reflection. Some of the other things you can do in there are, if you've got feeders, move them a little further away from the window. And if you've got branches where these birds sit right outside your window to sort of poise for battle, if you can trim those back a little bit, make it a little harder for the bird to get a direct mirror image of itself. And that can sometimes help. But good luck. You've got quite a challenge.
Nancy, thanks so much for your call. Nancy's call reminds me about bird feeders.
Okay.
And what you've said in the past, that where people decide to place a bird feeder and how they place it can have a big effect on any number of critters, not just the birds. So tell us about that.
That's correct. I mean, certainly we never seem to get far into a wildlife conversation before cats get involved. But one of the things that is important to consider when you are sighting a bird feeder or placing it is to place it away from cover that predators like cats can use to take advantage of the feeder and the attraction of the birds. An awful lot of birds are killed at the bottom of the feeder by ground feeding birds, like certain sparrows, things of this nature, because they're down there picking up the seed that is spilled, and the cats have easy pickings. And so if you're putting up a feeder, be sure that either you take great pains to keep the ground clean underneath it so that the ground feeding birds aren't down there, or more practically, keep it away from cover. Putting feeders right outside the window is also a difficult thing, because a lot of times birds will see through, especially if you have a house with a lot of windows like I. They look in one window and can see out the other window, and they try to fly through there. They figure if they can see through it, they ought to be able to fly through it, and that can be fatal. It certainly can also be a problem, as Nancy pointed out, just keeping the windows clean with the birds trying to get through there. But just some thought to the angle of the sun, as an example, on the western side of the house. If you've got a feeder on a west-facing window, and the low sun comes in directly at the window, that feeder is going to be in front of a mirror for all intents and purposes. And those birds are going to be whacking that window quite a lot. So get outside and look. Stand at your feeder. Look at your windows and really see how the reflective surface is there, because that's a big issue.
And as part of the concern is, if your bird feeder is in a location where other critters like raccoons or squirrels can get to it, and cats can also, then cats can just hang out by the feeder waiting to see if they can catch a raccoon or squirrel?
Well, they're less likely to catch the raccoon or squirrel. In fact, I would say they're almost never going to catch a second raccoon. Let's put it that way. They do occasionally get after the babies, but a raccoon can certainly take care of itself. So raccoons are not among the animals that we list as common cat victims. But little squirrels, absolutely. Rabbits, absolutely. Chipmunks in particular, the leading cause of injury that brings chipmunks to the wildlife center's cat attack.
So you want to think about trying to place the bird feeder in a way where cats cannot get
can't just lurk right around the bottom. Okay. And that's the big thing, because a lot of folks have bushes or shrubs right outside their homes, azaleas or boxwoods or whatever. And they keep those landscaped up very nicely, but then they stick a feeder right in the middle of it, and that is just, or put the feeder right at the edge of it, and that's just begging for trouble. And so we just encourage folks to think about the animals coming in, but think about the hazards that they have. And when you put up a bird feeder, you need to understand you're bringing an awful lot of animals together that might not otherwise come together. And these animals are concentrating in a way that can cause diseases and parasites to spread. So keep those feeders clean. Having a crusty old feeder that's never been serviced or maintained is not doing wildlife any friends.
We never have enough time when you're here, and we have less than a minute now. So let me end on a personal question. I'm just curious, what kind of pets, what kind of animals do you have in your home?
I've got 4 finches, 3 cats, 5 dogs, and 2 horses. My wife and I do. And fortunately, the horses don't come in the house, but the rest of them live in the house. And so it's not that big a house. So we're animal poor. Most of them are rescue animals, not the horses, of course. But a lot of our pets come from one form of rescue. All of our cats, all of the birds were rescues. Not wildlife, not native wildlife, but we live and work for animals 24/7.
Our guest has been Ed Clark, founder and president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia. Ed, thank you so very much. Looking forward to seeing you again soon, I hope.
I hope so, Tom. Thanks for having us.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Dan Easley is our technical director. Bob Levicky, associate producer. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jaspe and Inner Rhythm. Podcasts of this program available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will see links to more information about Mr. Clark, about the work he's doing, and about the Wildlife Center of Virginia. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.